everybody. What we're going to be learning about is basically just like what happens when the people who have the power don't deserve it and have it only because basically they have a lot of money. Now this has no relevance to anything that is happening in the world today. I want to make that clear. Anything, any relevance that you see, you read it yourself. But that's what we're going to talk about. And specifically from a scenario, a particular moment in history, which is the Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi. So I'm going to say a couple of things about the Talmud Yerushalmi, just so we know where we're at. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the earlier cousin of the Talmud Bavli, which is normally just called the Talmud. It's from the 4th century, the late 4th century. It has literally nothing to do with Yerushalayim at all. It was never in Yerushalayim. In fact, at the time, there were no Jews living in Yerushalayim at all. It was composed in the Galilee. But it became called the Talmud of Eretz Israel or the Talmud of Yerushalayim. You know what? Why don't you put these over there? And then at the back, and then you can point them people to it. So another thing that was going on in Eretz Israel around the 4th, 5th, 6th century is that synagogues were exploding. Synagogue construction, there were just synagogues everywhere. People were building synagogues, people were really excited about synagogues. And so here is one example of a mosaic in a synagogue. That's near our first page. As I said, it's late in the afternoon, so, you know, after lunch. So the first session after lunch, you need pictures to keep yourselves interested. So this is a nice little mosaic on the floor of a synagogue in the Galilee in the 4th century. This is one of the earliest synagogues, actually, we have in archaeology. Most synagogues are like 5th and 6th century. Now, my Greek is bad, but these are all in Greek. It's Greek to me, as they say. But you can see in sort of the second box from the top over here in the first column, I don't know if you can see this one. So the first name there is Eulos. Now, Eulos probably means Hillel. So it's a guy called Hillel, or possibly Judah. It might be like Eudos. Might get confused. So these are basically just names of, these are donor plaques, essentially. Right, so these are the names of the people and their titles about what they donated to the shul. Right? So this is the realia that we're talking about. These sort of synagogue officiants who are not rabbis, they're not related to our rabbis who put the Talmud Yerushalmi together, particularly. They're like slightly different groups. But they're the people who sort of run shuls. And there are all sorts of titles you find with these people who run shuls. One of them is Archisynagogos, which is the arch synagogue, i.e. the Rosh synagogue. So on the second page, I've got this extract from an analysis by these two people talking about what these sort of roles were, how these roles worked in synagogues based on inscriptions. And if you see this sort of the list of things that it is associated with the title arch synagogue, the head of the synagogue. So it says, basically you could sort of hand out these positions called jobs, or in Roman literature they're called liturgies. So it says administrative jobs required little expertise or investment of time compared with modern assignments. Your expertise doesn't count. It's not what matters. The primary criterion for appointment was not competence. Any definition of recognized merit would have to incorporate extraneous social factors. So you had to be a macha to a certain extent. There was a markedly close correlation between social standing and appointment to high position. You had to be pretty rich. And beneficence played a major role in getting chosen in the performance of the office itself, making wealth a sine qua non. In other words, in order to do this position correctly, you basically had to sign up for giving tons of money to the synagogue. So basically, that is both in order to get your position, you might have to donate to the synagogue, and then to keep the position, as part of your position, what you have to do is keep donating money to the synagogue. It's a bit like being on a board. Some boards are like that, where they like require you to donate a certain amount of money. I obviously have no idea about boards or money, but you know, there we go. Nonetheless, so that's basically the art synagogue and the kind of people we're talking about. So there are all these people out there who are sort of having their power in synagogues, who it may be totally unrelated to their competence, and in fact, what it's mainly about is their wealth. Yeah, please.
So I hear you on how they got into that position, but what power did they have by being in that position? What were they in charge of?
Yeah, so it's not clear at all. Partly because the different inscriptions use the same names to mean different things. But basically, it's like, you know, this person's in charge of the ritual committee. It's like, that's the kind of equivalent you should think about. Or like, this person's in charge of tzedakah, like giving out tzedakah to the people. Or, you know, some kind of role like that, some kind of communal role. Or like, yeah, this person's in charge of Torah reading, I don't know, something like that. Maybe, I don't know if they did Torah reading, these people, but maybe they did. Probably some of them did.
Unlikely.
Well, it depends. Well, yeah, whatever. So one of the things we'll have to see is like, okay, so we're gonna see the lens of our rabbis through the Talmud Yerushalmi on these people, but probably the truth is a bit more nuanced than the lens from our rabbis. Okay, any other questions about sort of this basic setup? And there are sheets at the back in case anyone didn't get. Great. Okay. So the way this enters the rabbinic conversation is through a verse in Vayikra, which is on the second page in the middle of the page. So this is one of those sort of classic verses in the Leviticus 19, especially Vayikra 19, which is the sort of the holiness code, whatever you want to call it. One of the classic verses where basically every single word is unclear. Okay? So let's see that. Mipnei seva takum v'hadarta pnei zaken v'yareta me'elohecha ani Adonai. Okay, so what do you think about this verse? Do you have any questions about this verse? Yeah.
Well, they have that in the buses in Israel.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's
right. Good. This is a reserved seat for...
That, you know, if an older person comes into the bus, you should get up and give them your seat.
Okay, very nice. Who decides who's an elderly person on those buses?
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the person's standing up, yeah. Yeah.
So there are a couple different ways that you could punctuate this, right?
I agree.
Mipnei seva takum v'hadar tapnei zaken v'yareta me'elohecha. Ani Hashem, so that those three things come together as a unit. Or you could say, Mipnei seva takum, v'hadar tapnei zaken, v'yareta me'elohecha, ani Hashem.
So what's the difference?
That the first two are kind of pathways towards fear or awe of God.
Aha, the first two sort of lead you towards the last two.
Yes.
Good, so that's one of my key questions here on this verse. What is the connection between the first two lines and the second two lines? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, what is the connection between standing before elders and fearing God? So one possibility that you raised is very good, which is basically through standing for elders, that's how you learn fear of God. How does that mechanism work, I guess? It's like you're learning respect, I guess.
In some, it could be about learning respect. It could be even just this is a bit more far-fetched and fanciful, perhaps. But you know, many people have an image of God as, you know, the old guy in the sky.
Right. Okay. So
if I'm looking at the old guy or the old woman in front of me, and I'm saying, well, you know, ooh, you're the closest thing that I see to God in
right,
the world.
Right. So there's a literal reading which we would be mostly uncomfortable with, but it could be honestly what they imagine, which is basically like the face of the elder is like basically the closest you can do to look at the face of God, because he's the old man in the sky. Right. Which is like, it could be what they're imagining, but it's hard for us to relate to that image. Yeah, please.
Maybe one of the reasons why it's a commandment that shall honor your father and your mother is because people are prone not to honor their fathers and mothers, and you don't have a law, or any of the 613, I mean, some have to do with the temple. You don't have a law when people aren't doing it anyway. You don't have a do not if
good.
People are not doing it.
Great.
So that's...
Great. So the point being here, people don't stand up for elders, so I'm going to command you to do it, and I'm going to add your extra oomph. Which is, by the way, there's no reason, there's no enforcing mechanism, right, for you to do this. No court is going to come by and say, hey, I hear you didn't stand for that elder yesterday, therefore I'm going to fine you 50 shekels. Like, that's never going to happen. The only enforcement mechanism is you have to fear God. So it's a reason to do it. Because there's no outside reason to do it otherwise. Very good. Any other thoughts about ambiguity about this verse?
I think there's a difference between honoring the face of a person and honoring the person.
Tell me, what do you think? I translated it very literally.
So if I honor the face of a person, I don't have... It's much more superficial.
Interesting.
It doesn't have the depth of honoring the person. It's acting as if I honor as opposed to honor.
That's interesting. Also, how does that relate to standing? Because standing is also very superficial.
Yes.
Right? It's not a deep level of honor. It's a superficial level of honor.
Right.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I'm supposed to stand for the queen, too. But it doesn't mean that I hold her in any particular esteem. But
great. Yeah,
but
please.
But you do it just because the person has the status of elder. You don't have to know them. They don't have to be a person worthy of your honor.
Good.
Through their deeds. If they're old, you honor them just that status.
Good. So you're saying, right, this is about age. And you can always tell an elder when you see one. You just stand. It's part of the procedure. Okay. You don't have to know anything deeper about that person. That's good.
You were saying it's superficial, but I just want to say it's sort of related to the discussion we had upstairs. It's an actual act. So you can talk about, oh, I honor my elders, I respect, I fear God, and you just all talk.
Right.
The question is, do you really stand up or not? And that,
right.
That happens... things like the National
Right.
You actually
stand. So that's a discussion now.
Yes. I think the fact that it's an action is really significant, even though it might seem
quite
mild.
Great, that's great. So even though it's a superficial form of honor, the fact that it's an action, it's actually something you can point to. This is something I do. Every time an elder walks past, I stand up. Right, good. Yeah, please.
So then if you want to go and carry that further into the next line, so if you're doing those superficial things, and it's sort of like Shai was saying upstairs before, you're doing the acts, and then you want to cultivate sort of this other internal thing. So Yirah, the fear, Yirah now comes in at a whole other level. So
great.
You learn to stand, you've learned to perhaps do that to the face.
Good.
And now we're...
Good. That's a very rough Shai read, which is basically like these actions sort of lead you to internalizing the concepts, and thereby you fear God. Yeah, very nice, very nice. If you were, think of it this way, if you were a rabbinic decisor trying to work out what the halakha is, what are the kind of questions you would have as well on this particular passage? Yeah, please.
It says, it's translated, honor the face of an elder.
Right there.
Could that also be translated, you should honor in front of an elder?
Yes, maybe.
That would mean the whole person.
Maybe, though Hadar Tapnei also just maybe the like Hadar Pani might just be the idiom that means to honor somebody. So I translated it hyper-literally because I wanted to make sure we saw all the words here. There's more to say about that. But while we're here, to talk about the word Hadar, given that you know we're at Hadar, it's actually a very interesting word. It appears a lot in the Tanakh, but almost never in the Torah. And it means honor. Basically what it means is honor, and I mean that in a serious technical way, like honor as in honor and shame. And in fact, pay attention to the root Hadar on Saturday night, because it shows up in Eicha all the time. Because it's all about sort of the woman Jerusalem has been dishonored to a certain extent. And again, I mean that technically. So the fact that it almost never appears in Tanakh is actually extreme, in Torah, is actually extremely interesting, even though it appears elsewhere in Tanakh. And there's more to be said about that, yeah.
But also, the word pnei is in the line before, so it's parallel.
Right, though that's mipnei. Yeah. So here's, it seems like the clearest way to read this, right, is the mipnei sevata kum v'hadarta pnei zaken is two ways of saying the same thing.
Right.
So the way in which you honor somebody is you stand before them. But it's not the only way to read those two lines. Right? You could read them as two separate things. Stand before an elder and honor a zaken. What is zaken? Okay, but that's a halachic question you have to ask. What is actually in these categories? Who is a seva? Who is a zakein? What defines it? And you'll see one of the things that that animates the conversation is that zakein is a way that our rabbis use to refer to themselves. Okay, when you become a rabbi, when you get smicha, you become a zakein. It's also, you can also see, and we can see that in inscriptions, the way that the shul officers refer to themselves. So now suddenly this verse becomes the site of a culture war. Right? Which kind of zakein do you have to stand in front of? Okay, and that's going to play out in the text. Okay, any other halakha questions you might have? I have a lot of questions. Okay, well, the Yerushalmi will ask some of these questions. Okay, so let's move to the Yerushalmi. So we're going to, I gave you the whole sugya, but we're actually going to skip around a little bit. Basically, here's one of the things about the Yerushalmi that is important to know when we're reading this, It's basically, it's less, what's the right way to say this? It's less filtered than the Bavli in a certain way. Like the Bavli sort of directs you to a way to read the sugya. It sort of gives you the signposts, right? Here's a challenge, here's a response. The Yerushalmi gives you almost nothing like that. Okay, the way when you read a Yerushalmi sugya, you normally end up sort of getting a few vignettes. And how they relate to each other is totally not clear at all. Whereas in the Bavli will normally say, oh, this thing says here, this thing says here, let's relate the two to each other and work out what it means. Yerushalmi almost never does that. So what we're actually going to be doing basically is just taking a few of these vignettes and try to work out what kind of picture it builds, and it will be a complex one because these vignettes don't necessarily agree with each other at all. Okay? Great. So someone will read for us from the beginning. We're going to do the first two paragraphs here. Please.
Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Bun, in the name of Rabbi Huna bar Chiya, come and see how great is the strength of those who do mitzvot. Since before an elder they do not stand, but before those who do mitzvot, they stand.
So what's his point?
That elders, just being an elder isn't as important as being... as doing mitzvah.
Okay, good. Being elder is fine, that's great, but doing mitzvah, that's amazing. Okay? So again, we've sort of tried to define Zakein as in alliance with someone who does mitzvot. Is this sort of a... Is he telling you you shouldn't stand before elders? No. I think he's just... But he seems to be describing the world around him. Right? He's basically looking at the world and be like, oh, nobody stands for elders anymore. But everyone stands for people who do mitzvot.
It could be, the other thing is this could be ironic or satirical. You know,
go on, tell me.
How great this person is. He thinks doing mitzvot is so great that he only stands for people who do mitzvot. Stand for the people who are commanded to stand for.
Right, okay, good. This is a huge problem of reading the Yerushalmi. The Bavli gives you a lot of signposts about which tone of voice to read something in. The Yerushalmi does not. Yes.
It's also saying that the elders don't do mitzvot.
Yes, it seems like just being an elder means that you don't just necessarily do mitzvot. Yes, exactly. Because he seems to understand elder, I think, as somebody who is old. Mm-hmm. Right? That seems to be the dichotomy here. Somebody who is old versus somebody who does good deeds. And somebody who is old doesn't necessarily do good deeds.
Just overlap.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, please.
It's a little strange because it seems to suggest that the people that are standing are those that do mitzvot.
Oh, really?
Never mind.
Yeah, before those who do mitzvot, they stand, i.e. everybody else stands before them. It will be clear in a second. Yes, please.
Yeah, but not thinking. Really, that's the distinction. The distinction is how great is the strength of those who do mitzvot. So if you're on the side of the angels, as it were, who do mitzvot, then you don't have to just stand up every time there's an elderly person passing by. You can say, like, I've got the core of Judaism for me, and I'm going to stand for other people that I respect. I'm not going to stand for somebody just to stand for them.
Great. Hold that. That's going to become very important. But we don't necessarily just stand for somebody because they're old. I'm going to choose who I stand for. That's going to be very important. Yeah.
And it's also kind of saying along that line, saying I'm going to choose to stand for somebody who does like me.
Right.
I'm going to acknowledge people who do mitzvot.
Right. How righteous does Rabbi Huna bar Chiya think he is? Right? He might think, I'm extremely righteous. I do mitzvot. Everyone stands before me. Yeah, exactly right. People stand before people like me. Good. Okay, should we do a second paragraph and try to put it together?
Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Bun said, those who stand before a corpse, they are not standing before a corpse, but actually before those who are occupied at the funeral.
So this is about a funeral procession, right? The funeral procession comes by, everybody stands up, and it's actually kind of a beautiful image. You think that you might be paying respect to the dead person, but you're not. You're paying respect to the people who are helping the dead person.
So, or to the krovim. Or to the people who are close to the
whatever. It's not
right, exactly.
Mourners.
Right. But the idiom in the Aramaic-ish is gmalim lechesed. Right? Gmilu chasadim in the Yerushalmi actually specifically means to help with a funeral. Often.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it's actually, so gmilu chasadim now is a very broad concept. For the Yerushalmi, it's very specific, actually. It's like helping with funerals and a few things like that. So this is just trying to illustrate, right, the point that we stand before people who do mitzvot. Okay, great. That's one vignette. Okay, I'm going to do vignette 2, which is going to be these first 4 paragraphs on page 3. Someone to take us away, please.
How many times does a person have to stand before an elder? Tumumbaba in the name of Reverend Mahone, twice per day.
So this is a classic kind of question you want to ask as a rabbi. Okay, Torah tells me to stand. How many times a day do I have to stand? Right? It's a good question. So we have 2 different answers.
But it is not taught. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, from where do we know that one does not have to go to trouble for an elder? That's why it says, elder, fear your God, I am Yahweh. According to the opinion of Rabbi Yohanan, this is fine. According to the opinion of Rabbi Lazar, he should not stand at all.
So this is now complex. This is where the Yerushalmi starts to get complex. This is a challenge on what we just had. So let's understand first the bit of what it's taught. What is Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar trying to say? From where do we know that one does not have to go to trouble for an elder? That's why it says, elder, fear your God, I am Yotevafe. So how what is he trying to say? How is he reading the verse? How is he reading the connection between the clauses? And which one is more important? Fearing God. The reason the verse contrasts standing before elders and fearing God is because the thing that really matters is fearing God. And standing before elders, who cares?
And the implication is that only elders who heed this commandment to fear God are worthy of anything. So that all that counts is fearing God.
Right. Good. Yes. So is everyone clear what they're trying to say? What he's trying to say is elders are not important. Forget about elders. Fear God. That's what you should be doing.
Unless it's saying, you elder, you should fear God. I mean, that's a different punctuation.
Yeah.
That's what he's. Yeah, that's also what he's saying. That's another way to read this. That's good. That's good. Yeah. So good. But actually, the verse is directed to elders. You know, punctuate the verse differently. It actually says, Zakein. Hey, Zakein, pay attention. Fear God. Don't worry about your honor. Worry about God's honor.
So until I'm an elder, I don't have to fear God?
Well, it may be the elder, the people who really have to learn that lesson.
This is before the conquest of Christianity. Christianity at this point was not the power it became later. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct.
So it is not a response to the whole question of the hereafter.
No, in fact,
you're... So that you're getting old, you're going to die, and then you could be in trouble if you haven't behaved yourself.
Yeah, it could be. It could be about that. I think, I mean, in terms of the Christianity question, the Yerushalmi never makes explicit reference to a fully formed Christian theology.
Because it wasn't.
Right, exactly. It's too early for that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, please.
I don't understand why they're asking about how many times, because it's not a time-based issue. If you saw no Zakenin that day, or you saw a lot of Zakenin that day.
Right. The question is basically, like, if you see the same elder, you work with a Zakenin. Right, how many times per day do you have to stand up for them? The answer is twice. I think that's what they're saying, but I could be wrong. Okay, so now that we've understood what Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar was trying to say, what he was trying to say is, elders, don't worry about them, fear God. Now, how is it a challenge against twice per day and once per day?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, any guesses here?
I don't understand the context. It says, elder, fear your God, I am Hashem. I don't understand. Where is that? Is that quote from the...
It's from the same verse. Yeah, Vayikra. He just cut it off. He cut it in half and started in the middle of the phrase.
The Tamei Mikra, don't...
Yeah, he ignored the Tamei Mikra.
They were there already at that point?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he just did a total reread of the verse where the verse actually cuts off halfway through a smichut. Right. Even though it's construct, Pnei Zakein, the face of a Zakein, you cut it off anyway. Doesn't matter.
So what is this business about reveal?
Okay, great. So let's talk about that. It seems like this is the Yerushalmi's assumption. The Yerushalmi's assumption is because of what Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, you should do a little bit less than you thought for elders. So what Shimon bar Va said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, he said twice per day. So you should downgrade that to once per day. You should just do a little less effort. But then you have a problem when you get to Rabbi Lazar. He says once per day. If you downgrade that, then it's 0 times per day. Okay? So this is like one of those cases. This is a case where Yerushalmi is difficult to understand because it made an assumption which is a bizarre one. But that is the assumption you have to make in order for this to make sense. So this is a nice brief intro to Yerushalmi. Right, the Bavli would explain that assumption explicitly, The Yerushalmi lets you work it out yourself. So there you go. But that's the point. The point is, Rabbi Yochanan said twice per day, Rabbi Lazar said once per day. This tradition seems to suggest whatever you're doing, downgrade it a bit. So it downgrades the twice per day to once per day and the once per day to zero per day. And now Rabbi Lazar says you don't have to stand before elders at all.
Except there's a question mark.
No, that's not
it. Yeah, that where he says, according to the opinion of Rabbi Lazar, he should not stand at all. Because so it can't be that Rabbi Lazar would say that.
Right.
You still have to fulfill it.
You still have to do the mitzvah. Exactly. So now we're going to try and resolve it. Every time of you're reading.
Rabbi Yaakov Bar in the name of Rabbi Lazar, that one who sees a group of elders should not pass by them such that they would stand before him.
So what does that mean?
Just avoid it altogether.
Yeah, it's like, don't go out of your way. Right? When it says, don't trouble yourself about an elder, what that means, according to for Rabbi Lazar, is don't go out of your way to like stand before elders. If they happen to go past you, fine, stand. But don't like seek it out. We're going to see examples in a second of people who like deliberately go seek out places and situations where they have to stand before elders.
But this is, they would stand before him. That seems to be the opposite.
Yeah, it's true.
You mean he or she, no?
No.
No, it does mean they.
Yeah, yeah. Is that what it says? You come along, Mikolai. Yes. Yes. So I think it could be like an elder, an even better elder. Like, don't go amongst other elders. Also, the Yerushalmi is sometimes weird and difficult, and sometimes has mistakes in it. So it's hard to know always exactly what you're saying. But I think the basic point is, right? Don't go crazy about this. Also, what we're talking about is actually a slightly different case because we're now going to relate it to our case. So Ruth, you want to give us the last line? Oh, sorry, apologies.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have the same disagreement about standing for elders as they do about greeting elders. Okay, how many times a day do you have to greet an elder? The answer is twice or once. Okay, so I put this in Latin here, the salutatio. That's because that's a Latin institution of when you have a teacher, you're supposed to like go out of your way to say hi to the teacher in a particular kind of greeting. So it's like they seem to be talking about the same kind of institution. And here, Zakein has started to mean, based on that, it started to mean teacher, not just old person. Okay, so the question basically is, how much trouble do you have to go to in order to stand before elders? And there's some varying pieces on that. Some people are like, you have to go to a lot of more trouble, some less. But twice per day is not a huge burden, right, I think. I know it depends how many elders you have. Maybe you have like 10 elders, 20 times per day, but I think that's fine. Okay, so that's another vignette. So I want to take us for vignette number 3, which is the next 3 paragraphs. Please.
Rav Hiskia, Rav Hanina bar Rav Abahu, in the name of Rav Abduma from Haifa. For an elder, 4 amot. When he passes, he sits for him. A high priest, anyone who sees him, stands until he is hidden from him.
Okay, so what does the 4 amot mean?
Until the 4 amot passed. Like 4 yards.
Exactly. While the elder is within your 4 amot, that's when you have to stand for them. 4 amot, by the way, is about the distance of a person, right? The amount of space a person takes up, right? And amma is like here to here. So here to here, here to here. Here to here, here to here, 4 amot. Okay? So basically, if they're in your personal space, you have to stand. If they're not, you don't.
4 amot, is that what it's saying?
Yes. If they're within 4 amot, then you have to stand for them. If they're not within 4 amot, you don't have to stand for them. And as soon as they leave that 4 amot, you can sit down. Yeah, you were going to say, Karen?
Yeah, just that we're talking about 2 different kinds of elders here. It's Kaim, meaning elderly people,
yep.
Versus a high priest who is a leader.
Good.
Yes. I thought this session was about the years.
Yes. So we're gonna get there.
Okay.
The point is that the it slips a lot.
Okay.
And this is a good example of it slipping because we're explicitly relating it to high priest, who is clearly an official. And the procedure for standing before a high priest is even greater, right? Everyone who sees the high priest has to stand. This is like the Torah.
And I was also thinking about the fact that in many religious circles, people stand for their rabbi and so.
Yes. Exactly right, exactly.
Not necessarily a zakein.
Good, so you're going to see. We're going to see the word zakein that has to apply to rabbis as we go. Yeah, 100%. Okay, let's continue.
What's the reason why Moshe left to go to the tent the entire people stood.
Okay, so what's the reason in the Yerushalmi always means what's the scriptural proof? So the scriptural proof is Moshe. Everybody stood when Moshe came. Okay, is Moshe the elder or is Moshe the high priest? Why?
Because it wasn't about a specific district.
Because everybody stood. Okay, good. So it seems like he might be the high priest. But what happens if you read him like an elder? Or saying is Moshe Rabbeinu is the elder par excellence. I.e. us, who are all Rabbeim, are also elders. But I agree that the easier read is probably he's the high priest. Yeah. Okay. Great, and this is where it gets really fun. Please continue. Yeah, please.
Two Amorim. One said this is for praise, and one said this is for shame. One who said for praise, see this righteous one and merit. One who said for shame, see his thighs, see his belly. He eats from what is the Jews. Drinks what is the Jews, everything that is the Jews.
So what are we talking about? I think we're talking about the high priest, because we're probably not talking about Moshe. Okay, so we're probably going back to the high priest, because everybody knows the high priest in the Second Temple period were extremely corrupt. Okay, so why do you have to stand for them? One person says you stand because you want to see them and merit from seeing them. And the other person says you want to stand for them in order to see how fat they are. Right? And then to make fun of them for it.
The Philip Roth of his time.
Right. Right. This is kind of amazing, right? We've actually totally flipped the standing. It's no longer honor, it's shame. For the high priest, for somebody in official capacity, who's like all of their own has been stolen from the Jews.
I read it a little differently. I thought that it was saying that the Amorim were disagreeing on whether you should stand. One said, if you stand, you should be praised. The other says, if you stand for this person, you should be ashamed, because if you look at his thighs and his belly, he's not worthy of your standing. Am I putting something there that...
No, it's possible that's what it means. But I think the easiest way to understand it is to go back to the Kohen Gadol and why they stand.
So the second one is encouraging the standing for the purpose of shaming?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a total flip of the verse we started with. And now gets into the conversation of who are the leaders that actually deserve our standing and why are we standing for them anyway? Okay? Great, we're going to skip the next two paragraphs. Start with Rabbi Hila. Someone to pick up. Do all a great job, I haven't said anything. It's great. Please, please.
Rabbi Hila and Rabbi Yaakov Bar Hidi were sitting. Shmuel Bar Va passed by, and they stood before him.
Okay, so what do they think about Shmuel Bar Va?
He's
an elder, some kind of elder. It's like, hey, whatever that means in this context.
Or he's
okay.
Fat.
Or he's really fat. Yeah, exactly. Right. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, done.
So he said to them, you have made two mistakes. One, since I am not an elder. Another, since the Torah does not stand before its child.
So what are the two? What is his 2 points?
He's a teacher. They're his teacher.
Yeah, you're my teacher. You don't get to stand before me. The Torah doesn't stand before its child. Why are you standing before me? Okay, so now what is the honor all about?
Torah.
Okay, the whole point of this honoring is about Torah. We've moved from age, and now we're into Torah. In fact, he might mean elder, meaning I'm not a rabbi, because he's Shimon Bar Va. He's not Rabbi Shimon Bar Va. Yeah.
The child piece here could also mean that he considers himself a child of Torah because he's a student and a teacher. It doesn't necessarily mean he's the child of the...
No, not literally child. Well, he's just saying...
No, I know, but I mean not even metaphorically the child of the others, that he's a child of the Torah.
Right, I agree. Yes, but what he's saying is basically like, I'm the child of a Torah and you are the Torah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there something going on here about humility also?
Yes. So Shimon Bar Va is going to come back again. We've already seen him once, actually. We saw him say something in Rabbi Yochanan's name, and now we've seen him again, and he's going to come back a third time, and then we'll see it's all about humility. It's going to be good. Okay. Let's go to page 4.
This is Shmuel Bar Va, and up there at the top of the page is Shimon Bar Va.
Oh, yeah. Same guy. Yeah, same guy. Yeah. Also, sometimes it's called Shimon Bar Abba. Shmuel Bar Abba is the same guy. It's all.
Okay.
There's lots of different spellings going on. Because yeah, whatever. Okay. Shmuel and Shimon get confused all the time. And also Yishmael, like all of them, they're like so much flux between those names. Okay. So on page 4, we're going to start with the second paragraph, Chizkiah, for our fifth vignette. Someone to take away? Please.
Chizkiah bar Rabbi used to wear himself out studying his work. He would go and sit before the assembly house in order to see elders and stand before them.
Okay, so this is the case of somebody who went out of their way to see elders. Okay? Where is the assembly house? So I think most people will tell you that this is the Beit Midrash.
Yeah.
So therefore he's seeing rabbis. Beit Vad is the word. Beit Havad. I actually want to say that this might be the synagogue. You know, the Beit Knesset, the place where people gather, the assembly house. So I want to suggest this is actually him sitting outside the synagogue watching the elders come in and out. Okay, so he's so tired, right? After every day, he gets so tired, he's just working with Torah all the time. And then at the end of the day, he goes, sits in front of the shul in order to stand for everybody who walks out. That's pretty great, okay? Keep going.
Yehuda Bar Chiya used to go back and forth to pay respects to Rabbi Yanan, his father-in-law, every Friday. He would sit in a high place in order to see him and stand before him.
Okay, so who is sitting in a high place in order to see who and stand before who?
Yehuda is sitting in a high place to look at his father-in-law.
What's your support for that reading?
Just what the way reads to me.
Because Yehuda is paying respects to Rabbi Yanni.
Right. Sorry.
Okay, good.
Or is it still talking about Chizkiah?
No, we've left Chizkiah. We're done with Chizkiah. That was it. We're done with him. He was a short-lived character.
Okay.
Yeah, no. You never know where the plot is going to go in these. Another way to read it is that it's Rabbi Yanni who is sitting and waiting for Rabbi Yehud, for Yehuda Bar Chiya. And in fact, you'll see as we go through, that's how you have to read it. So the very point of this is that they're flipping the normal relationship. You would think that Yehuda Bar Chiya should stand for Rabbi Yanai, and actually Rabbi Yanai is like waiting for to see him in order to stand before Yehuda Bar Chiya.
Because he's a rabbi?
Well, we'll see why. His father-in-law. He just thinks he's awesome, apparently. He thinks his son-in-law is just the greatest guy ever, as we'll see. Yeah. And Leah?
His students said to him...
So this is Rabbi Yanai's students.
Is it not the law, Rabbi, for an elder, for a mode?
So what's the point of that question?
Why are you standing?
He's miles away. You just see him across the hill. Why are you standing up? The law is for Amot. Okay.
He said to them, there is no sitting before Sinai.
So who is Sinai?
Wow.
Yehuda Bar Chiya. You can't sit at Mount Sinai. Okay. Great.
One time he was late.
So this is Yehuda Bar Chiya was late.
It is not possible that Yehuda, my son, changed his practice. He said, it is not possible that trouble have afflicted this righteous body.
I.e. Yehuda's body, i.e. he can't be sick, because he's too righteous to be sick.
It seems that we no longer have Yehuda Bar Chiya.
So he works out that he must be dead. Because this Yehuda Bar Chiya was so righteous, the only possibility of why he would miss his appointment with his father-in-law is because he was dead. How many people like that do you know? Okay, so again, now we're back into the conversation of respect is about Torah. And actually totally upends the normal hierarchy. Right? Normally, Yehuda Bar Chiya should stand before Rabbi Yanai, but actually Rabbi Yanai wants to stand before Yehuda Bar Chiya. Okay. The next paragraph begins our sixth vignette. Someone want to pick up?
When Rabbi Meir saw even an Am Haaretz elder, he would stand before him. He would say, it is no accident that days are lengthened.
So who's an Am Haaretz?
A person who's uneducated.
Yeah, somebody who's not careful about tithes, minimally, and maximally someone who's not a rabbi. So basically, Rabbi Meir sees even a random elder, a random old person, he gets up before them, and he says, it's no accident that days are lengthened. What does he mean by that?
God is rewarding this person with long life.
Yes, it must be this person is righteous because he's still alive. Okay? So again, he's talking about, superficially about standing before elders, as in people who are old, but actually what he's made it about is merit. Mm-hmm. The only reason someone would be old is if they merited it. Okay. Yeah, please.
Rabbi Meir said to him,
So people who die young are only the wicked die young?
No, that's definitely not what Rabbi Meir would say. Rabbi Meir definitely doesn't believe that. But what he does believe is there's a high chance that somebody who is already very old probably was a good person. That's where he is going. Only that and no more.
Even that,
I understand. But that's what Rabbi Meir says. Yeah, I understand. There's obviously many problems you could draw on that. Okay, we have two more paragraphs of this vignette.
Rabbi Hanina would strike anyone who did not stand before him and say to him, do you want to annul the Torah?
Okay, so who's the Torah in this circumstance? Rabbi Hanina, right? Rabbi Hanina talks about himself as if he's the Torah, and every time someone doesn't stand before him, he smacks them. It's like, you want to annul the Torah? Look at me, I'm awesome. Okay? Great. So this is like kind of like the flip side of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is like so humble that he stands before everybody, they must be meritorious, and Rabbi Hanina is like, everybody has to stand before me. Okay.
Right. Before gray hair, you should stand. You should honor the face of an elder, and you should fear your God. I am Hashem. I am the one who put standing before an elder first.
So, what is he trying to say about standing? The relationship between the different parts of the pasuk. What's the order of the pasuk?
Yes, whatever.
God comes first.
Does it?
God comes last.
Yeah, elders comes first, and then God afterwards. So what he's saying is that order means that God wants you to consider an elder's honor above God's. God himself is the one who said, I put an elder before me. You should be more considerate of an elder's honor than mine. Okay? This is the flip side of what we had before, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, right, who said basically, fear God is the main point. Don't care about elders. Fearing God is what you have to care about. Whereas here we're saying the opposite. God's self says you have to care about elders and not you don't have to care about me. Okay. So you can also see how this sort of like the Yerushalmi sort of bounces around. We sort of joined the discussion that we left a while ago and left the discussion we were actually in at the time. But now, on page 5, we're going to get to the real meat. Where we start talking about those who were appointed for money, which seems to be the people who were in shuls who managed to get their liturgy by donating tons of money to the shul. Okay, that's where we're at now. So someone to pick up first two paragraphs there.
When the head of the court enters...
Apologies. Of section 2, I didn't say it clearly enough.
Oh.
Where it says appointments. So they wanted to appoint Rabbi Zera, the third paragraph, the fourth paragraph.
I'm sorry.
It's my fault. I didn't make it clear.
All right. Okay, strike him. Do you want to? Okay, Rabbi Simon.
They wanted to appoint Rabbi Zera.
You can pass. It's okay. We can come back to you.
Yeah, I see. They wanted to appoint Rabbi Zera, but he did not want to accept it. When he heard this teaching for a sage, bridegroom, or nasi, greatness and tones, he accepted his appointment.
Okay, so now we're going to have to explain this teaching. But basically what he's learned is that appointments wipe away your previous sins. So now we're going to explain it. Oh. So next paragraph.
A sage, before gray hair, you should stand and you should honor the face of an elder. What is written afterwards? When a convert lives in your land, you shall not oppress him. Just as a convert is forgiven all of her sins, so too an appointed sage.
Okay, so now appointment is like converting. When you convert to Judaism, you become a new person. Right. All your previous sins are thrown out of the window. Similarly, when you become appointed, all your sins are thrown out of the window. So this is an extremely positive view of appointment, right?
That's not a thing. He's saying he's starting it.
Well, he heard it from somewhere else. When he heard this tradition.
But also that means...
So he heard this somewhere, and then he was like, oh, this is great! Appointments are awesome! Why have I been saying no all these years? Okay, and then he became the chief of the ritual committee, whatever it is. Yeah. Any more questions about this? Okay, great. And then they go and prove the others, bridegroom, nasi, but whatever. So also, when you get married, all your sins are forgotten. I don't know if you realize that, but I hope you used it to good effect. If you were married, and if you're not married and want to be, I hope you do use it in the future for good effect. Now this is the time to know. If you're not married and want to be married, this is the time for you to know this tradition, just so you know. Okay, so now we're going to go down to Rabbi Mana, after Nasi paragraph. So I'm going to pick up.
Rabbi Mana, curse those who were appointed for
him. Okay, we're just going straight in there. Okay? Those people who got their appointments through paying money, hate them. Okay? Keep going.
Imi applied the verse to them, you shall not make for yourselves gods of gold, of silver or gods of gold.
So what does he call these people?
Idols.
They're not idolaters. They're actually idols. The people who stand for them are idolaters. Okay? So that's huge. Right? Suddenly the rhetoric just totally changed, right? Okay. Keep going.
Rabbi Yoshiah said, and the robe that is on them is like a donkey's.
So what does he call them now?
Donkeys.
Right. Literally asses. Exactly right. Okay, good. And it might indicate, by the way, that when you've got an appointment, you might get a special robe. Not sure if that's true, but it definitely would be consistent there. But, you know, who wouldn't want a special robe? Okay, let's keep going.
Rabbi Shaya said, those who are appointed for money, they do not stand before them, nor do they call them rabbi. The robe that is on them is like a donkey's.
Okay, right. So saying a similar thing, but he also added, you don't stand before them. Uh-huh. I.e., they call themselves a Zakane, they are not a Zakane. They fall outside the purview of this verse. Okay?
Rabbi Zaira and one of the rabbis were sitting in line. One of those who was appointed for money passed by. That one of the rabbis said to Rabbi Zaira, we shall occupy ourselves in our learning and not stand before him.
So in other words, who are they honoring instead of the person who walked past them? The Torah. They're honoring Torah over the elder who walked in front of them. Okay? So they're like, we'll make it look like we haven't noticed them. But actually, we notice them, we hate them, and we prefer the Torah. Okay?
They're feeling like very trite kind of people.
What do you mean?
They're you missed it.
Yes! So here's they're really animated about this. It actually gets a bit worse. So someone to read this Yaakov of Kfar Gvuraya.
Yaakov of Kfar Gvuraya. Translated.
So translated, that means he's probably sitting in shul. You should understand this, okay? He's standing in the front of shul. He's translating the Haftarah, which turns out to be this Habakkuk verse that he's about to talk about. And just imagine all of the shul officials sort of sitting in their box in the shul. Okay, imagine this scene. This is what happens. Okay, yeah.
Ah, you who say wake up to wood, awaken to inert stone. He teaches? Does he know how to teach?
I.e., the people who are appointed for money, do they know how to teach? The answer is no, obviously.
He seizes gold and silver, but there's no spirit inside him. No, he is appointed for money, and he knows nothing. But the eternal, in his holy abode, this is Rabbi Yitzhak Bar Lazar in the gate synagogue of Kesar.
So, he's standing there, saying to their faces, all the shul officials, saying to their faces, in the middle of shul, Shabbat morning, says to them, you are all basically idols. You're empty. There's nothing in you. Who should you really be appointing? Rabbi Lazar. Or his name? Yitzchak Bar Lazar. That guy is great. In other words, maybe rabbis in general. You've got the wrong priorities, shul. Can you imagine ever somebody in shul saying this today?
Yes.
Yeah? Have you been there? Have you seen it happen?
Yeah. No, but I think what it brings to mind.
Tell me.
It was a tradition. It was a long time ago because I'm very old. But sometime in the 60s, I think, Paul Moore, who was the Episcopal Bishop of New York, waited until Easter Sunday. And on Easter Sunday, he gave a sermon that said, prominent business people would take their businesses out of New York are committing a sin. And he did it in front of people who were all doing that, and he actually made the front page of the New York Times.
Wow. Right, it's an incredible amount of courage to some extent. It's basically you have the wrong priorities. You are all idiots, essentially. So there's a certain amount of hubris, but also a certain amount of courage. So, take it or leave it. Okay, let's finish up with our last vignette, which is going to be on page 7. So we've covered a lot, you'd learned a whole sugya almost. Okay, so we're going to start in the third paragraph, which is Rabbi Chama. Okay, someone, Rabbi Chama. What's his name? What can I tell you? Yeah, please.
Rabbi Chama said, Yehuda ben Titus was in Rome, and they appointed him with the understanding that he returned.
So what exactly this means is not totally clear. It could mean that he has to come back to Eretz Israel at some point. It could mean that he only gets a temporary appointment. We just sort of finished up a conversation that we skipped about appointments outside of Eretz Israel, but I put it in here for context because what we're talking about is sort of people being outside the influence of Eretz Israeli synagogues, but still being appointed somehow.
And Shimon Bar Var was in Damascus, and he appointed children, though he was not appointed.
What did he do, and why? This is Shimon Bar Var, right? Remember him?
Yes.
Yeah. He was pretty humble earlier. So why do you think he's going around appointing children, even though he's not appointed?
Mad
about what?
That he's not appointed.
Okay, good. So that's number one. One possibility is he's not appointed. It's so annoying. So I'm just gonna appoint children. See what happens. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're young, so they're not corrupted yet, and it's a statement about corruption.
Ah, beautiful. Right. Remember when we looked at the four characteristics of the art synagogue, which applied to other synagogue people? Competence was irrelevant, right? So children could do the job just as well as anybody else, right? So there's a reading of that, which is basically like, these adults who are running it are terrible and corrupt. These children are not. Let them run the shul. They may as well do it. Anyone can do it. Okay? Any other reads of this? Yeah?
This is going to seem totally random.
Unlike this story.
Zikuchin means like meritorious, right? Zikuchin?
Yeah, it can be. It means sort of attached or like obligated.
Okay, I'm wondering if Dickie Keen here might actually be Zikukin. Wondering if that changes the meaning of everything at all. Just a
side point. Yeah, Dickie Keen is the word translated children here. I went with Sokolov.
Okay.
So you can look into it.
Sokolov says an important.
He's an elder, apparently. Okay. There's at least one other reason I can think of why he's doing this. There are probably others.
Go ahead. Could it be to dismantle the system?
Yeah, that's the other kind of thing. Basically, it's like he's making a mockery of the whole thing.
Right. Yeah.
This system is so broken, I may as well go around appointing children. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah, hands down. So those, I don't know exactly where in all of those it fits, but maybe we'll make a determination at the end. Okay, yeah, please.
This is a real insight. Is it possible that Yehuda ben Titus is a Roman?
Well, so his name is Jew. Ben Titus.
Yeah.
So he's a Roman Jew, yes.
Well, I'm wondering if he's just a Roman and if he's also part of the mockery.
Yeah, I think that basically the reason is that the Jews of this period had a lot of Greek names.
Mm-hmm.
So even our rabbis did, and people not involved in our rabbis certainly. So I think this is just like, such and so, the assimilated Jew who lives in Rome, Yehuda ben Titus.
I'm thinking the Arch of Titus.
Yeah, no, it's not about the Emperor Titus. I think Titus is like a fairly common name.
Okay.
Okay, so let's continue with Shimon bar Var, because there's two more things to say about him.
Shimon bar Var was an expert in everything about pearls, but he did not have a loaf of bread to eat.
Okay, so in other words, he could be wealthy, but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Rabbi Yohanan used to apply the verse to him, but the sages, the Chachamim, have no bread. He said, anyone who doesn't recognize the deeds of Abraham should recognize the deeds of this man's ancestors.
So what's he trying to say about Shimon bar Var?
He's a good guy.
He's the best. He's the best. Okay? Even if you don't think Abraham was good, and by the way, Abraham was great, right? That's the subtext. But you can disagree with that or not, but that's what he's saying. Even if you don't think that Abraham is good, you have to acknowledge that this guy's amazing. Right? This guy came from great ancestors.
Saying that he could be a business person making a lot of money, but instead he sits and learns Torah?
Could be. It might be. It might also be sort of his circumstances as such.
You should respect him even though he isn't rich. Come on, you're appointing all these idiots like Scott Pruitt.
Good. We'll get... As I said, any relevance to the modern period is your own device. Yeah. No, it could be, yeah. I'm not sure exactly. My sense is that basically, like, he could be one of the elders in charge of shuls, but either chooses not to or has been deliberately sort of put aside, shunted. Okay, should we continue with Shimon bar Var and put it all together?
Shimon bar Var was in Damascus, and Rabbi Abahu sent him a letter. He gave him one of his gray hairs, saying, because of this gray hair, rise and go to Eretz Israel.
So what did he essentially do to him? Shimon bar Var said before that I'm not an elder. He made him an elder. Here, have a gray hair. Now you're an elder. Done. Okay?
They say that.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly right. Now you're an elder. Because you're an elder, come back. There's Israel. Okay?
Who threw dust in your eyes, Rabbi Yohanan, of the low-quality cloak is appointed. Shimon of the high-quality cloak is not appointed.
In other words, how come it went so long before Shimon Bar Vi was appointed? He should have been appointed long ago. He's such a great person. Okay? So, let's step back. We've seen a lot of these sort of vignettes. What is, like, basically what's going on? What do you think is happening here? What's in this conversation? What have you brought out of this? Let's try and piece some things together. What running themes have you seen? Yeah.
So, it seems to me that they're saying some people are deserving of respect and other people are not. But exactly who is deserving of respect?
As is always the case. Yeah. Right. 100%. Good. Good.
There is this nice thing about you can't tell just by looking at somebody.
Right.
You can't tell by their age, you can't tell by their appointment, the level of appointment that they realize, or someone can't tell by the level of wealth in which they're...
How fancy their cloak is. Right.
Those are not indicators of who deserves to be respected.
Good. Good. So it fights against the superficial reading of that pasuk. But what it's about is just like superficially showing respect, but not actually honoring a person in full. What the conversation here gets us to, no, you have to actually honor that person. That's where we're headed, yeah.
Just to piggyback off of that, there is definitely a bias towards, well, the more money they tend to have, the less likely we are to respect them, however.
Right, right. Anti-snobs.
Right, yeah. But if they happen to be, you know, an Aster who also... has a lot of Torah, then that's somebody who we can respect.
Great, great, good, yes, right, right. There's a generally an inverse relationship between wealth and respect, but not always, but there is a direct correlation between Torah and respect. Yeah, I agree.
And between wealth and appointment.
And between wealth and appointment, exactly, and therefore when these intersect with Torah and appointment, then you're good, but often they don't intersect. In fact, they often anti-intersect. If that's a real word, which probably isn't. But there you go.
Like you're speaking from personal experience.
Okay, good. So their personal experience is probably
immediate disgruntled.
Right. Right. So there's a certain way of reading this information, like, we're not wealthy, so we don't have access to all of this stuff. And the community is being led by these people who are empty, who are like totally corrupt, basically just idols. So what are we gonna do? Like, we're gonna like stoke resentment about that. Ourselves. That's definitely a reading of this material.
I'm interested too to understand, and we can't probably know this because we're so far removed, but these subversive suggestions about how to handle these misguided appointments, I wonder what sort of impact it had on the societal relationship to power and money and positions of notoriety.
Right, interesting. There's sort of subtle ways around it where you're like, oh, we're just learning Mishnah. Like, we didn't see you, but actually we saw you and learned the Mishnah instead. Yeah, right. Very interesting. Yeah?
So, the theme of the day is virtue, and I'm not seeing virtue anywhere. The rabbis who are arguing that these people don't merit being stood for, I think are without virtue themselves. The implication that I have the ability to judge you fully enough to decide whether or not I can ignore a piece of Torah text is kind of mind-boggling to me.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm not impressed by...
Yeah, right, right. Here's it gets you to the rub, basically. Whenever you're reading about a conflict from one side, like, where is the truth?
Right, and there's a piece of Torah text that says, stand up for your elders.
Right, though I would say that it's always in our purview to understand when a Torah text applies. That's
yes.
Like, that's always in like the people living it out's purview. So, but yes, I agree. There is, it's not like nothing is on the line. There is actually a real Torah text on the line, so you shouldn't
right.
be, what's the word, lax about it. You need to be careful about it. I agree with that.
So
but,
I'm struggling yeah. with where the virtue is here.
Right, right.
Well, the Torah text either says, stand up own person, or it says stand up before a sage, and they're saying these appointees are neither.
Or neither, yes, exactly.
Right. They wouldn't even think the Torah text applied.
Right, exactly. That's what I was saying. I'm suggesting that they're perfect. But your point is still well taken, which is that basically, like, these are people who are attacking other people for their lack of virtue, and in so doing, displaying their lack of virtue.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that.
It's so frustrating that you're keeping this in a Talmudic.
I know. I mean, obviously, we should bring it up, but yes, 100%. And yeah, and one of the, yes.
They're talking about what was going on in their day.
Right, exactly. Exactly, that's the point. Exactly the point. Yeah, so what's interesting about this, I would say that, like, basically, yeah, the truth of the matter is, we don't have a lot of material from the people who ran synagogues, but they must have thought that what they were doing made sense, right? So if we, like, tried to speak to them and tried to work out what they thought, maybe we'd have a different perspective on this. But unfortunately, we only have our perspective from our rabbis, and you should read it as a perspective, not as the truth of what's going on.
But there is a certain notion. Alluding back to the past, like when the original text was written, the elders were the leaders of the community. They emerged from the people. They were people of wisdom. They were people who deserved respect. And now it's all gone to hell in a handbasket. I would say it's certainly true now. You can't really tell people by their cover, so you have to really raise questions about that fundamental biblical verse because it's not so clear anymore.
Right.
Elders was a shorthand when the Torah was written.
Right.
Elders was a shorthand word for people
right.
who emerged naturally
right.
as our leaders, people
right.
of wisdom.
Right. And those things have diverged.
Right.
Right. Because the people who emerge naturally as our leaders do not have wisdom. Yes. Right. Or, you know,
or
morality. Or virtue at all, yes.
We've made them ours.
But they also make kind of the categorical claim that anybody with the title rabbi deserves that respect or standing. Which is also, I mean, even though we say we can't just categorically say we're going to stand or respect anybody who's an elder because of their age and experience, do we necessarily respect
right.
the title? Just
good.
The title thing?
Good. And you have to be suspicious of that as well. I think what they would say is, like, basically, we're just trying to read the Torah and we're trying to live a life of Torah. Like, we're trying to be the best people we can. They're just trying to look out for whatever advantage they can get. That's what they would say. That's what our rabbis would say about it. And I want to play out that sort of cultural war for 1 second here. So I told you how the word honor almost never appears in the Torah and appears a lot in the rest of the Tanakh. And I think that's actually something very deep to that. But we'll talk about that when we get to, we're now going to get to section 3 here. So section 3, this is actually a passage from the Bavli, but what it gets to is exactly the cultural war that they're talking about and the cultural war that we're still fighting, which I basically want to set it up in the dichotomy of sort of basically like Rome versus Torah. Okay, so this is what happened. This is the text. This is the question that Quintus Tinius Rufus, the wicked one, asked Rabbi Akiva. Now, Tinius Rufus is the general in the Bar Kokhba revolt. So this story is classically, so he's representative of the Romans. This story is classically read as part of Rabbi Akiva's martyrdom scene, though actually nowhere in this text does it say that Rabbi Akiva is martyred. But that's how it's traditionally read. So he says to Rabbi Akiva, if your God loves the poor, why does he not provide for them? You tell me God loves the poor, why are they still poor? Okay? He said to him, in order that we be saved through them from the judgment of hell. It's actually not for the poor, it's actually for us. It's for us to give tzedakah to them and for us to get merit by doing that. You can think whatever you want about his answer, but that's the answer here. Also, yeah, whatever. I mean, what do you say to a Roman general asking that question? I don't know. Okay. He said to him, the opposite. This makes you liable for hell to give to the poor. I will tell you what this is like. To what is the matter similar? To a mortal king that was angry with his slave and threw him in jail, note the British spelling, commanding that no one should provide him food or water. One person came and provided for him food and water. When the king heard, would he not be angry with him? And you are called slaves, as it is said, for the Israelites are my slaves. In other words, God created the status quo. If you try to upend the status quo of wealth and power, right. you're going against God's wishes. That is Rome. That's the opinion of Rome here.
Correct.
Everyone who thinks this, if you're already in power, this is what you think. Right. This is the way God wants it. If you try to change that, then you're going against God's wishes. And you're slaves to God. Okay. This is what Rabbi Akiva says. I will tell you what this is like. Your parable is bad. I'll give you a better one. To what is the matter similar? To a mortal king that was angry with his son and threw him in jail, commanding that no one should provide for him food or water. One person came and provided for him food and water. When the king heard, will he not send him a gift? And we are called sons. As is written, you are Yahweh God's sons, etc. Okay, so Rabbi Akiva's view is the opposite. It's like, yes, God was angry with them and that's why they're poor. But God actually loves us and doesn't want us to be poor forever. The status quo is not forever. The status quo is for a short time. And actually, God wants us to upend that status quo. God loves it when we do that. Because we're actually children, we're not slaves. Okay. Then they have another discussion about the Torah. He said to him, this is the general, you are called sons and you are called slaves. When you do God's will, you are called sons. And when you do not do God's will, you are called slaves. And now you are not doing God's will. He's basically saying, what do you mean? You're slaves. I'm Rome. You're the slaves. You clearly must not be doing God's will. That's why I'm Rome and you're slaves. Okay? Basically doubling down on that. So therefore, if you try to upend the status quo, you're going against God's wishes because you're slaves. He said to him, yes. Yeah. He said to him, thus he says, this is the fast I desire. This is the Haftarah from Yom Kippur. Is it not to give your bread to the hungry and to bring the wretched poor into your house? When does the wretched poor into your house apply? Today. And he said, is it not to give your bread to the hungry? No, actually this principle that you have to give to the poor applies all the time. I.e., in this vision of Torah, Torah stands for the possibility and in fact the requirement of trying to upend the status quo. Right? And I think you can see that a lot in the Torah, which is basically like, you know, the you think one brother's going to get the birthright and then it swaps at the last minute. Right? The one who wouldn't classically deserve it is the one who is really deserving and then gets it. Right? I think this ends, the Torah is all about this kind of last minute, suddenly, you know, the people who were slaves, suddenly they're free, beyond all hope. And that's the cultural war. It's the Torah versus Rome. It's the status quo is temporary. We have to remedy it. We have to overturn it if it's unjust, versus the status quo is how God wants the world. Any attempt to change that is going against God's will. It's trying to change something that can't be changed to a certain extent and shouldn't be changed. And I think this, if you like, think about this dichotomy through the lens of our Yerushalmi, then their opposition starts to make a lot more sense. Because they're not just opposing to these specific people. They're opposing to the whole system where honor and shame is attached to wealth and power, right? Where honor is wealth and power. And that's Rome, right? Rome is all about honor. And what they're saying is, we stand for the Torah. We don't stand for Rome. We don't accept that wealth gives you positions of power. And we don't accept that the traditional categories of honor are why you should rule over us. We actually believe in the Torah. Merit is why you rule over somebody. Great. So I think that gives you a little bit of a better spin on them rather than like, oh, they just really hate people. which honestly they might. Like, I'm not saying they don't. But I think that's how they would see their conflict. Like, we are standing for the Torah. And the Torah stands against the status quo.
So it said the Torah stands for virtue.
Yes, and for justice. And the people who learn Torah, we're trying to get that virtue in order to change the world, in order to upend the status quo when it's unjust. Yeah, please, we have 6 minutes.
That's the sense, and this could be an incorrect reading, but they were talking about learning Unlikely. Torah, not doing good deeds.
Yes, so then the question is, what is the point of learning Torah? I guess into that discussion as well, yes.
Yeah, but the Talmud, when they want to say, you know, it's because Rabbi Meir went to the town and gave enough money for everyone to eat for Shabbat, you know, they do that.
It's true, though we did also see at the beginning, we talk about standing for people who do mitzvot. But yes, it's certainly true that when they try to avoid standing for these appointed elders, they take refuge in their Torah, learning.
In learning and knowledge, not in doing good deeds.
Yes, though I think you can always argue that subtext. I mean, I think like there are rabbinic books that talk about Torah learning like this, like the Sifrei Dvarim talks about this a lot, the early Midrash to Dvarim talks about like those are the virtues you're trying to inculcate by learning Torah. I agree that it's not always obvious that learning Torah leads to doing Torah. But this is also something Rav Shai always says, right? What's greater, study or action? study or action, and the answer is study, because it leads to action, which means which is better, study or action, right? You're back to exactly the same place where you started. But yes, okay. Yeah, any other questions? Yeah, please.
It still feels a little unsettled as to guidelines about who you respect and honor.
I agree.
Who you stand.
And I think that's in some ways intentional. Basically, like, the world is really messy out there, actually. It's very hard to know who you should respect and who you shouldn't. Though it's getting easier in the last couple of years, but... yeah, so... But I think that's kind of intentional. Like, really, you should be trying to work out and assess those people and try to work out who actually deserves your respect. I think, honestly, this Yerushalmi would be a perfect text to learn about kneeling for the national anthem, in a sense. So, it's like, actually, like, I can't have respect for this right now, to a certain extent. Anyway, any other questions or thoughts? Great. Yeah, please.
This was maybe too big a question, but off to the side a little bit, but it feels like, particularly the last piece of the conversation we're having was about justice. So what's the relationship between justice and virtue?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that what they're saying here is basically, what is a just way of people being ruled in the world? It's people being ruled by those of virtue. Uh-huh. I think that's where it really like hits home for virtue here. So basically what they're saying is the people who are in charge of shuls are only at it for themselves. They need people who actually just are virtuous people instead.
Yeah. What do you know about the place of the rabbis in Judeo-Palestine, whatever it was called then, versus the synagogues? I mean, did the synagogue like run the little Jewish community?
Basically, yes. The synagogues are basically in charge, yeah. It's like very much power dynamic. The synagogues...
These guys have their Beit Midrash off to the side.
Basically, yes. It's actually... they had more interactions with the general synagogue population than they did in Bavel. But nonetheless, they're like very much not in power. That only starts to happen in the Middle Ages. Once you get sort of 7th, 8th, 9th century, that's when they start to be in power. There's an inscription of a passage of Yerushalmi on a 6th century synagogue, late 6th century synagogue, I think. That's the first time we have any independent evidence of rabbinic literature in Eretz Israel. Basically we have tons of evidence of shuls. It's clear that the majority of the Jewish world then was shuls. We like dig them up every 5 minutes. But there's no archaeological evidence of rabbis at all in that time.
Really?
Yeah, like none. Like
rabbis, what did you say?
Rabbis at all. They didn't make a mark on the archaeological footprint until like the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries. So yeah, there you go.
Wow.
I can recommend books to you about it.
I would be interested.
So you should read Seth Schwartz. He actually writes about this passage.
Seth Schwartz?
Yeah, basically anything he reads is great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Seth Schwartz.
Schwartz at Columbia.
Yeah, it's how I learned this sugya originally was from Seth Schwartz.
Schwartz?
Yeah.
Schwartz.
Yeah. How do you spell Schwartz?
My reading is a bit different than his.
But the regular way.
Yeah,
the right. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.